now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. For more than 6.5 years have passed since Saudi Arabia initiated its onslaught on the Yemeni people, a violent bombing campaign of the infrastructure as well as civilian areas caused an extensive amount of damage, and more importantly, it caused the loss of so many lives. However, the tide has changed as the Yemeni army currently has the upper hand and is now on the verge of taking over the oil-rich city of Ma'arib. Is defeat near for the Saudis and all of their allies from the Persian Gulf to the West? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight. I'm going to start this discussion off crossing over to Sana'a, talking to Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Thank you so much. Actually, the Yemeni army managed to liberate the Al-Falaj area. The Saudi coalition have a military checkpoint in that area, and so many travelers have been or have got kidnapped in that military point. It is the eastern gate to Ma'arib. The Yemeni army managed to liberate this area, and this is an important point for the Yemeni army, and important advantage for the Yemeni army to keep encircling the city and liberate the city from the Saudi bankers and also from the terrorist group. Actually, the leader of the Al-Qaeda in the Syrian peninsula, Khalid al-Baqarah, admitted that they have been fighting alongside the Saudi coalition forces in 11 military fronts, including Ma'arib. He said that their participation is inconsistent, and no one can deny that. And this admission refutes the allegations of the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi coalition that they are not using terrorists to fight the Yemeni army. Yemen's armed forces have been saying that for 7 years, that they are not fighting only the invaders, but also the terrorist groups working in Ma'arib or in Al-Bayda or Taiz or Hudaybah or the front across the country. In Al-Hudaybah, the Emirati-backed forces have suddenly withdrawn their forces from so many areas, and I believe that they will continue their withdrawal to lift the city for the Yemeni army to control the city. Military experts say that this withdrawal comes in the process of gathering the forces to protect the Bab al-Mandab state and also to protect the south of Yemen, as the Yemeni army is liberating Ma'arib just a matter of time, and they want to lift Ma'arib and think about what will be after the falling of Ma'arib in the hands of the Yemeni army.
All right, thanks so much. That was our update out of Sana'a from our correspondent on the ground there, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in House Up with Brett. As time goes on, why does it appear to be more difficult for the Saudis to inflict defeat on the Yemeni army?
I think the main reason for this is that the Saudis have gone to war with much the same strategy as their overlord, so to say, the Americans and the Israelis have always been doing. That is the shock and awe strategy, the idea that by overwhelming them with military hardware, with military prowess and power, by a massive display of what you can field in battle, that will overwhelm the enemy in to such an extent that they will completely collapse, that their morale will collapse, and you can basically take over the country in a matter of weeks. That's the idea, the strategy, the doctrine that is behind a lot of the invasions that the United States has waged in the past 20 years. It is the strategy behind what the Israelis are doing in Palestine for decades now. And it's the same doctrine that the Saudis have been trying to use. Unfortunately for them, the shock and awe doctrine is completely and utterly useless against a nation that is united in a common cause, because you cannot defeat a country with military hardware alone, especially if that military hardware, like the Saudis and the Americans and the Zionists, when that military hardware is specifically aimed at air superiority. And that is what we have seen for so long already. One of the first things that the Saudis did when they attacked Yemen is almost completely destroy the Yemeni Air Force. And that's why, up until this point, the Yemeni Air Force is nearly non-existent indeed. The Yemeni Air Force as a unit still exists, but the majority field drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't have any airplanes. So Saudi Arabia still maintains air superiority, just like the Americans have done when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, and still like what the Zionists have over Palestine right now. But the problem is, you cannot defeat a country like that. You cannot win a war just by bombing alone. You can win battles, you can advance rapidly, but you cannot maintain. And that is exactly what has been happening here. The Saudis have been overwhelming the Yemenis in the beginning of this war, have been advancing many, many hundreds of kilometers into Yemeni land, but they have not been able to really capture large territory of, like, large population centers, especially in the north and in the west, where the population of Yemen is majority local.
So was it, let me just jump in here, was it a total miscalculation? Let me throw this, let me cross over to London and say it, Mohsen. How do you see it? Was there a total miscalculation going into this to begin with by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, by their those who support them, like the Americans and the Brits?
I think there was a huge miscalculation. I mean, they called it the Operation Decisive Storm, precisely because they thought that it would be all done and dusted within 3 or 4 weeks. That's exactly what bin Salman, who initiated this war, thought, what he intended. Of course, that comes as a complete shock to them that it hasn't worked out that way. The American intelligence has obviously failed on this. The Zionist intelligence has failed on this in terms of giving the Saudis insufficient reports on what the Yemeni morale was, what the Ansarullah's morale was, what their capabilities were. Those capabilities, of course, have grown rapidly during the war since 2015. But at that time, clearly they got some very, very bad intelligence. And what actually has transpired is that the Saudis have now spent in excess of $300 billion on a war against almost the poorest, if not the poorest, nation on the Arab Peninsula. And in return, they've really failed in every target that they had. In fact, the reverse has happened. The Yemeni Ansarullah forces have not only held them up till 2018, but actually in 2018 turned the tables on them and actually went for the jugular, went on the offensive. And that offensive is absolutely mind-boggling, because the equipment of the Yemenis, the tactics of the Yemenis, the strategies of fighting, etc., have been absolutely amazing and a real kind of eye-opener for any military.
What do you think has been key in that, Said Mohsen? I mean, you talked about the offensive and how they have turned the tables. I mean, what has been key in that, being able to turn the tables, even though you just pointed out rightfully, it's totally inequitable if we compare the type of equipment that both sides have?
Well, number one, the Yemenis have a huge faith. This is really not to be underestimated. Their spiritual and religious commitment to anti-oppression, towards against tyranny, against the Saudis' tyranny, of course, but also the Zionist tyranny, was totally, I think, underestimated by their enemies. The tactics that they've employed have been unique, insofar as they haven't gone out and fought like a standard army, if you like. They've not really battled in those formations that you'd expect. And what they've done is they've employed methods of hit and run, methods in which small groups of small units have gone in, done the operations, and then disappeared into the sand almost. And I think that's perplexed and totally bamboozled a Saudi military which was armed to the teeth with missiles and all the latest hardware. How do you fight an army which can disappear not only into the desert, underground, overground, wherever, or even into the towns and villages? You're basically fighting the people. So where are you going to find these forces to fight? Not only that, they've actually demoralized a mercenary army, because the Saudis didn't want a boots-on-the-ground situation. Because the air power failed, what they did was started to import mercenaries from Sudan, Somalia, other places. So these mercenaries that they're fighting are not dedicated to any cause or commitment, whereas the Ansarullah are fighting for their families, for their children, for their nation. There are many differences to this virtual victory, I see.
Okay, well, Brett, tell us the importance of what is happening right now, because we know about the situation in Ma'arif and the offensive and every day having more and more victories, the importance of capturing Ma'arif.
We have to bear in mind that Ma'arif is the last and only major stronghold that the Saudis and their supporters still have in central and central northern Yemen. Except for Ma'arif, their entire stronghold, their entire foothold in Yemen is almost entirely concentrated in the thinly populated, be it strategically located, south and east of Yemen, which is very sparsely populated, which is not a very well-developed area when compared to the more populated areas that are still under control of the National Salvation Government and protected by Ansarullah and their allies. So when Ma'arif falls, this will be a very massive blow, not just militarily, but also economically and spiritually, mentally, for the Saudis and their allies. We already know, of course, that the Saudis, when it comes to Yemen itself, to Yemeni troops, the few Yemenis that are fighting on their side are for the majority members of the Islam Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan movement in Yemen. And we know that within the Islam Party there is a growing rift that has started, especially in Ma'arif, in which some groups of the Islam Party are thinking of negotiating and have already even offered certain venues of negotiations that so far unfortunately have not yet led to a capitulation of the city. But it is definitely a start. And one of the reasons for that being is that the National Salvation Government still to this very day offers a general amnesty to every mercenary, every Yemeni who joined the Saudi forces, who decides to defect, put down the weapons or hand in their weapons, and decides to return back to civilian life. It is perfectly still, or that venue is still open. So aside from that loss of a major Islam Party stronghold, the potential loss of the last vestige of northern and central Yemeni power that the Saudis still have, there is the massive economic importance in terms of oil and gas. Not so much necessarily that the Saudis need the oil, but the oil is now at least kept out of Yemeni hands. That is their goal, trying to keep the country as poor as you can be. If that oil were to go back into Yemeni hands, and Yemen could possibly, potentially in the near future, negotiate further economical oil deals with other countries, if the government of Sana'a could somehow manage to sell that oil on the international market again, this is a massive influx of funds again that belongs to Yemen, but so far has been kept out of Yemen for almost 7 years now. So when all these things come together, and we have to bear in mind that at this point it's not only in Ma'arif, but also the east coast, the areas have been liberated at a rapid pace, just today there was a report that the Kilo 16 area, which is the major road between Sana'a and Hodeidah, mm-hmm. has been liberated and has been reopened after 3 years of Emirati blockade. The Emiratis have retreated. The Yemenis have moved back in, and the road, the direct routes between the major cities of Sana'a and the major port city of Hodeidah, both of them who are in hands of the National Salvation Government, that road is open again now. There is a direct line of transportation from the port to Sana'a. All these things taken together, it represents a complete and total breakdown of Saudi and Emirati stranglehold in central Yemen, which means that they will have to withdraw almost completely to the south, to Aden and to Hadramaut.
Okay. Well, said Mosa, let's look at the Saudi allies, I mean, such as the United States and Britain. Both countries had discussed the need to curtail sales of further military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but we've seen the opposite. The Biden administration has recently approved $500 million more. I mean, why do both these Western countries continue to show their hypocritical policies when it comes to Yemen? On the one hand, it says that the violence must cease and civilians should not be killed. On the other hand, we see that they continue to support the Saudi regime.
Well, the entire strategy and policy of if you like, Zionist exceptionalism across the world, and of course the domination of that region and the plunder of the resources of that region has relied fundamentally on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been the one that has been buying a lot of the nations around that region with its dollars, persuading them, maintaining a status quo, making sure that they didn't rebel against the Zion American order in that region. So Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin, really, for Anglo-Zionist policy and imperialism in that region, keeping all of the nations to heel. The reality is that the situation is changing. The resistance axis has fundamentally changed the dynamics in this region. For the relevance of Yemen, of course, whilst it was under the Saudi yoke, Yemen was not allowed to access its nickel, gold, copper, cobalt. You know, the oil and gas fields have been mentioned, but there's been a huge amount of wealth which has been suppressed by the Saudis. They've not allowed the Yemeni rulers who were their puppets to unearth any of those. You've also got this entire situation, for instance, with the outcome of the current situation changing the face of West Asia, potentially. What happens in Marib is no small thing. It could literally change the face of West Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. The Bab el-Mandeb Strait leads straight to the Suez, so that immediately hits Israel and Egypt. If the Ansarullah were to take control of that entire strait, it would cause huge problems for the likes of Israel and Egypt in their strategies and policies. It would be a win-win for the likes of China and the Islamic Republic of Iran, who would essentially have a major ally on the Arabian Peninsula, a diehard ally in a way. This has been hard won. The 13 out of 14 districts that have been now defeated or brought under control by the Ansarullah have come at a cost of many, many lives. But they are now at the point where only the city itself is running free, and they have maybe one base, a Saudi base in the region, which is there, which will very likely easily overcome.
Okay.
80% now, if this happens, 80% of the Yemeni population will be governed by Ansarullah. That is huge. And they, as my colleagues stated earlier, they control the water and the oil of the nation, which actually will boost, give a morale boost to the entire resistance movement there, if you like. So it's no mean feat. If this actually goes through, even the likes of the United Arab Emirates, who control the ports down in the south currently, and who nurture Al-Qaeda, ISIS types in their midst, all will be under a huge, if you like, decision-making process they'll have to go to, because already Dubai and Abu Dhabi have been threatened by drones and missiles by the Ansarullah, but they haven't gone for their jugular. The Saudis have tasted that threat very, very consistently, but it remains to be seen that if the UAE is turned on, how long they would even stay around in the south once it falls.
All right. Well, Brett, a former Trump official, David Schneckner, has said that the U.S. must prepare itself for the Saudis losing in Yemen. What does this mean exactly? I mean, on the one hand, is it that Washington actually realizes that the Yemeni army and people will be victorious soon? And on the other hand, if it does realize that, why then does it continue to support what Riyadh is doing?
I think we must not underestimate, of course, the power of what is called the war hawks in the United States, both in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the State Department, and in the House of Representatives in the United States. There is a massive support base of both the typical neoconservative war hawks, as well as the war hawks on the liberal side. And of course, something that must never be forgotten, the Zionist lobby, which has a massive influence, unfortunately, still to this day, in United States policies. And you see with people like it starting in with Obama and continuing under Trump, and now as well continuing under Joe Biden, that on both sides of the aisle, be they Democrat or Republican, you have those people who are diehard, dyed-in-the-wool supporters of the Zionist project, who are backed by the Zionist lobby, who are bought and in the pocket of the lobbies of the military arms industry. And Joe Biden is most definitely a very good example of a quote-unquote progressive liberal war hawk, because he has been in the pocket of these lobbies since decades already, so this should not be surprising. Of course, what we do see now is that there are more and more, recently there were 30 senators just a few days ago, who in the U.S. Senate have proposed a total ban on supporting Saudi Arabia. These are people who have seen that there is no point in supporting this war any longer because their defeat is already certain. And these are people who most likely are not considered, have not been bribed yet, or are not considered important enough by the lobby to necessarily buy them. The interesting thing is that both Trump and Joe Biden, when they were running for president, they both of them agreed and promised to their electorate and were elected partially by people who wanted to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. They both promised that, both from a Republican and a Democratic point of view, that they would stop supporting Saudi Arabia. Of course, the moment they get elected, they have completely withdrawn that promise and done the absolute opposite. Because again, you know, these lobbies that are at work behind the scenes. But when you see now that how the situation is going now, I think the United States will have, and that is what this former advisor of Trump's, I think, is getting at, the United States will have to come to terms with the fact that there is no future for this war to go their way. It is as good as impossible that the Saudis will win this in a normal military way. And in order, of course, to pull as much as they can out of the fire, let's say, from the U.S. perspective, they will have to pressure Saudi Arabia to negotiate. They will have to pretend that it was not the United States is doing, but it was more like, you know, a mistake made in Riyadh and by Riyadh alone, because they don't want to happen what my colleague here said. They don't. Americans, of course, don't want Yemen to really completely go on the bandwagon of the axis of resistance. They don't want Yemen to be an ally of Iran, an ally of China, of Russia, and of the axis of resistance of Palestine, of course, in general. So they will probably try to somehow get in Yemen's good graces again in order to try to deviate the goals of the revolution.
Okay. Let me just get said, Mohsen, in 30 seconds. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brett. Just 30 seconds, said Mohsen. You heard what Brett said, that this would probably what they would try to do. Do you think that they would be successful in actually then trying to negotiate with the Yemenis and trying to prevent, as Brett had said, basically this major support or expansion of support of the resistance? How do your assessment of what's going to happen? 30 seconds. I know it's not a lot of time, but I know you can do it.
Well, very simply, no. The Americans have lost faith and trust. And not only that, let's not forget the Ansarullah have an ideological base. That ideological base is anti-tyranny, anti-imperialism. They will not drop their guard. I think if they would come to power, they will be a fair, just government, but they will not kowtow to the Israelis or to the Americans, nor will they cut deals with them.
I'd like to thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. The historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Helsinki, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alam takun ayati tutla alaykum fakun.
It will be said, were not my verses recited to you and you used to deny them?
In the previous program, we started talking about the 104th verse of the chapter, تَلْفَحُ وُجُوهَهُمُ النَّارُ وَهُمْ فِيهَا كَالِحُونَ. The fire will burn their faces and they are glum therein. The next verse says, أَلَمْ تَكُنْ آيَاتِ تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ فَكُنْتُمْ بِهَا تُكَذِّبُونَ. They will be told, were not my signs recited to you, and then you used to belie them? In the previous program, we mentioned that the unbelievers suffer both physically and spiritually in their painful punishment, and this verse is mentioning part of their punishments in hereafter. But those who are righteous and love the Almighty Allah are completely different to those whose balance is light. Let's have a look at one of the narrations providing the insight into such a noble personality. One of the companions of the Infallibles says, one moonlit night, I was in Mecca, and when I was circumambulating the sacred house, a sad yet beautiful voice gently touched my ears. I looked for the person possessing the voice, and my eyes fell upon a tall, handsome youth whose face showed the signs of goodness. With the curtain of the sacred house in his hand, he was supplicating to Almighty Allah and said, O my master, O my lord, the eyes of your servants are now closed by sleep, and the stars of the sky are going toward the west. so the eyes can no longer perceive them. But you, Allah, the Alive, the Eternal, neither slumber nor does sleep overtake you. Now at this time, in the depths of the night, kings have the gates of their palaces closed and have assigned guardians to watch them, and friends are visiting each other in privacy. The only door opened to the supplicants is the door of your house. Now I have come as a wrongdoer, a needful, to the door of your house, and I have come hoping that you, the merciful, will shower me with blessings. O the generous, I have come begging your grace.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Then I saw the young man started reciting some lines of poetry. He continued reciting some more astonishing and interesting poems in this content, and he continued supplication till he fainted and fell on the ground. I went to him and I stared at his face. I looked at him carefully and I recognized him. He was the Hazrat Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. He was Imam Sajjad. I put his head on my lap and I wept uncontrollably for his condition. Then one of my teardrops fell on his face and he opened his eyes and said, "Who is it that has distracted me from remembering my Lord?" I said, "My master, it's me. Why do you cry so much and why are you so restless? You are from the household of the Prophet. Has not the verse of the purification been sent down concerning you? Has not Allah said about you, 'Allah's wish is but to remove uncleanness from you'? نَمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ." The Imam sat up and said, How far Allah has created paradise for those who obey Him, even if that person is an Ethiopian slave. He has also created hell for those who disobey Him, even if that person is one of the nobles of the tribe of Quraysh. Have not you read the Holy Quran, and have not you heard this verse, and when the trumpet is blown, there will be no relationship between them that day, nor will they ask of one another? فَإِذَا نُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ فَلَا أَنْسَبَ بَيْنَهُمْ يَوْمَئِذٍ وَلَا يَتَسَأَلُونَ. And this companion says, "When I saw that this was the case, I went away and left him alone." So this is what happens when the servant realizes
where he truly is, and he is always shedding tears and supplicating his Lord. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavik Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a two-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreements. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over seven decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abu'l-Ata, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abu'l-Ata triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abu'l-Ata was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abu Alata. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abu Alata in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country. The conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan but also for its neighbors and the region. This is a time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotovly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotovly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
What is the evidence for this? People were opposing
the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who has spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Puriza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayed Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said, The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the US and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony. What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China, and the US favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the US has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints, and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts.